It's the Goon Show night, BBC Radio 2, and I'm
Eddie Izzard. In half an hour, an astonishing recreation of a lost Goon Show that was lost, but is now found by a dog called Buster. But right now, let's travel back with Dennis Norden to a long time ago, just before Goonrise.
Take it from here, don't go away when you can take it from here. Why don't you stay and maybe join in the fun now, the show has begun. Half an
hour of laughter beckons. Good evening, this is Dennis Norden, bringing you the story of what happened in BBC Radio Comedy just before Goonrise. We're talking about the late 40s and the new world that began on the 6th of August 1945.
Scientists, British and American, have made the atomic bomb at last. The first one was dropped on a Japanese city this morning. It was designed for a detonation equal to 20,000 tons of high explosives.
The voice of Frank Phillips, guaranteed to wipe the smile off your face no matter what he was reading. From that moment, I suppose, we were living under the shadow of the bomb, as people liked to proclaim at the time with a slight touch of pride. But there were plenty of other shadows to live under back in those 40s days when the only rock group was the Royal Geological Society, the only Indian takeaway was John Wayne, and lifting a five-pound bag of groceries could give you a hernia. As for our public transport, well, that was a meaningless universe all to itself, as Max Wall described in a Victory Star show produced by Pat Dixon, an important name in the future Goon history.
Well, I suppose when it's time for the train to pull out, you wave your whistle and blow a long blast on the flag. He said, no, we don't use the whistle. The engine driver's deaf. He can't hear it. I said, well, don't you wave the flag? He said, it's no use. I said, why? He says, the engine driver's colorblind. And even if he wasn't, it wouldn't be any use. I said, why? He said, the flag's a black one. I said, why is it black? He says, I've been cleaning my boots with it. I said, does the guard know you clean your boots on his flag? He said, oh, yes. I said, isn't he annoyed? He said, oh, no. I said, why not? He says, he cleans his boots on it as well. I said, well, how do you get the train started? He said, well, we usually send a little note along saying you may now start. I said, well, that's very, very charming. I said, I suppose you write that in invisible ink. He said, no, I can't write. I said, you can't write. I said, what about the engine driver? He says, oh, that doesn't bother him. I said, why not? He said, he can't read.
Later in life, Max Wall took to acting in Samuel Beckett plays, but there was nothing in them that he hadn't considered already. In fact, the Theatre of the Absurd had been with us for decades in Britain. It was called the Music Hall. Here's Billy Bennett in wartime presenting a picture as surreal as anything in The Goons.
She was happier when she was poor, when she only weighed 7 stone 4. Now she's 18 stone 6 and as fat as can be, where the mountains are moored and roll down to the sea. Each day in the large beauty parlor, they iron out her wrinkles galore. They pummel and punch to get rid of her fat. They pummel so much that her spare tire's gone flat. And her backfiring nostrils now blows off her hat. She was happier when she was poor.
What is goonish about that is the explosive element in the tableau. Both Spike Milligan and Harry Secombe have been blown up on active service, and Goon Show humour would always feature loud bangs. They were hard to get away from, even at home in London, as one pair of comedy veterans found out live on the air in 1944.
Claude Halbert now appearing in Panama Hattie and Enid Trevor.
Here I am. I've just made the most amazing discovery. They're absolutely necessary in all walks of life.
What are absolutely necessary in all walks of life?
Feet was the answer, but, of course, nobody was listening by then. A flying bomb had fallen on the Regent Palace Hotel next door to the theatre. But a curious thing about that clip is that the play on music for Hulbert and Trevor was called Crazy People, the title under which the Goon Show was first broadcast. By 1945, the demobilised future goons were trying to put the memory of bomb blasts behind them. The young Spike Milligan, who at that time bore a striking resemblance both in face and figure to the young Frank Sinatra, used music to put his world back together as a guitarist and trumpeter. Spike had entered show business as a member of the Bill Hall Trio, but in a letter seeking a TV audition in 1947, he announced a change.
I have teamed up with another guitarist and singer, Reg O'List, who you may have known at the Windmill Theatre. We present a very colourful act in rumba costume, and our numbers comprise sambas, begins, rumbas, etc. We feature the two guitars and the two voices.
Spike did manage to secure an audition nearly 2 years later. Harry Seacombe, meanwhile, was touring with his famous shaving act, demonstrating how various famous people would wield a razor. It usually went down well, though he was once paid off by a theatre manager in Bolton who told him,
"You'll not shave in my bloody time."
Of the future goons, the most desperate to get into radio was Peter Sellers, self-billed on his professional notepaper as the bang-on comedian. Another explosion. He once told Michael Parkinson how he tricked his way into broadcasting.
And I noticed that Roy Spear was doing a show at the time called Showtime, yes. And one of the big shows on the air was Much Burning in the Marsh. It was Kenneth Horne,
right,
and Dickie Murdoch.
Right.
So I phoned up and I thought, being a senior producer, Spear would probably know Horne and Murdoch, you see, who were very big then. And I thought, if I click with the secretary, I'll get through, right? So I said, hello, this is Ken Horne. There's Roy there. Now, once she said, oh, yes, he is Kenneth, I knew I was right. So, got on there. Roy said, hello, Ken, how are you? I said, listen, Roy, I'm phoning up because I know that new show you've got on, Showtime or something. Dickie and I were at a cabaret the other night, saw an amazing young fellow called Peter, what was his name? He said Peter Sellers. I said, Sellers. Anyway, I think it would be very good if you had, probably had him in the show, you know, or something like that. Just a little tip. We just go around looking, you know. He said, well, that's very nice of you, you know. And then it came to the crunch, and I said, it's me. He said, what? I said, it's me, Peter Sellers, talking, and it's the only way I could get to you. And would you give me a date on your show? And he said, you cheeky young sod, he said. He said, what do you do? I said, well, obviously do impersonations.
So Sellers made his radio debut on Showtime, a New Faces type of programme, introduced by Dick Bentley, with links written by Dennis Norden. These newcomers were coming into a radio comedy world that was in a bit of an uproar. The traditional wartime hits like It Ma, It's That Man Again with Tommy Handley were still running, but there were a lot of young men like me and Frank Muir, my eventual writing partner, who wanted to try something fresh. We all made some false starts. Frank pinned his comedy hopes on a comic called Peter Waring, who was regarded by the BBC as a promising discovery.
Hello, everyone. The BBC did want me to do a ventriloquial act. The dummy has dry rot. It's all right, though. He's standing for Parliament next week. That leaves me a little alone, but I still have the birds. Yesterday, I was just about to throw them some bread, and a sparrow opened his mouth and said, watch out, there's a copper. But it's all right. This policeman arrived with some soldiers, brought me a whacking 16-inch cannon. I said, what on earth this? And the officer said, that's all right, old chap, we've just brought your railings back. But,
The corporation gave Waring a short series, but midway through it, they discovered he'd formerly worked for the BBC's own accounts department, where he'd embezzled a sum of money. He was allowed to finish the series, but they didn't feel that they could offer him any further employment. In the end, Waring went back to jail and died there. Altogether, it was a disconcerting story for a young comedy writer to be involved in. But a more general difficulty for those of us in the trade, Frank and I described as comedians' labourers, was that so many comics adopted a brash American style of patter. In a Stephen Potter programme called How to Broadcast, that tendency was satirised by, of all people, Roy Plumley.
I was walking along the street just now, and I saw a man I know. His name was Smithers Pomfret, and he was carrying a zither. Well, he was the third man I'd seen with a zither in a week. Oh, well, that goes better with film fans. He said, how about a quick cuppa? So, of course, I said, suits me to a T. Well, that's what it says in the script. No wonder the scriptwriters are starving. Well, where was I? Oh, yes. I was having a cup of tea with a sailor.
It was the ambition of some of us never to have to write that sort of stuff. But the BBC itself was sensitive about American influence. In 1949, when the notorious Green Book of Instructions for Variety Producers was given out, a special paragraph decreed,
the BBC's primary job in light entertainment must be to purvey programmes in our own native idiom, dialects and accents. The Americanization of British scripts, acts and performances is therefore most actively to be discouraged.
That must have come as a shock to the eccentric producer Pat Dixon, whose office had an American rebel flag on the wall behind his desk. Looking back, I don't believe we took the slightest notice of the BBC's instruction. How could we, when there was so much American raw material waiting to be fashioned into comedy? Here's our take on a fashionable US concern of the time, soil erosion.
Grazing grounds for our cattle are reduced. Riverbeds are dry and empty. The only way the fish can keep alive is by spitting on each other. Like radio comedians. But what steps are being taken? Let us consider a typical farm in America's Middle West. Let the figures speak for themselves.
My name is Jake Figure. All my life. Yes, I'm all my life I had the urge to grow things in the soil. Why, at the age of two, I was planting radishes in my sister's mud pack. Oh, yes'm, I got me a 40-acre farm. It was arable. Then I got me a wife. She was arable. But then we were happy together. After 10 years striving, we had 4 children and a cow. Money. Yes, money was coming in.
Hey, Jake, will you kill me a chicken to take to market?
You want to pull it?
Nope. I'll carry it in the shopping bag.
Yes, this was the corn belt, all right.
Jimmy Edwards, Joy Nichols and Dick Bentley in an early edition of Take It From Here, the radio show that Frank Muir and I managed to establish. Surely America was fair game and the home of some of its own fairly crazy comedy. Spike Jones and his City Slickers already took a goon-like interest in detonations, raspberries and general mayhem of sound effects.
In some secluded rendezvous that overlooks the avenue, with someone sharing a delight, chat, there's some bad and cocktails for two. As we enjoy a cigarette, to some exquisite chansonnette, two hands are sure to slyly meet beneath a serviette with cocktails for two. My head may go reeling, but my heart will be obedient with intoxicating kisses for the principal ingredient. Most any afternoon at 5, we'll be so glad we're both alive. Then maybe fortune will complete her plan that all began with cocktails for two.
It's also known that the goons in their early get-togethers at Jimmy Grafton's pub listened on shortwave radio to the broadcasts of the American comedian Fred Allen, in whose scripts goon was a favourite word. Oddly enough, when Fred Allen made a rare appearance on British radio, he was teamed with the suave film star George Sanders, whose voice and manner inspired Peter's goon character, Gritpipe Finn.
Mr. Allen, I beg your pardon.
Yes, Mr. Sanders, what is it?
You know, this is my first appearance on this show.
Yes.
Now, is it true that there's a clause in my contract that after this performance I must go out with the star of the show?
Oh, yes, yes, Mr. Sanders. If you will strike a match and hold it in directly in back of clause 4, you will notice that it lights up. And it says, quote, "Your engagement on this show is not considered complete unless and until the star has been properly wined and dined to her utter satisfaction. Any commitment above and beyond this is made at your own risk. Dress optional."
The American dollar is not worth that much.
Oh, well, she pays for everything, Mr. Sanders.
Does she have a lot of money?
Oh, she is loaded.
Yes, but does she have a lot of money?
The very question Gritpipe Finn would have asked. With George Sanders in his repertoire, Peter Sellers, by late 1948, was so much in demand as a radio impressionist that Con Mahoney,
assistant to the head of Variety,
had to circulate an exasperated note about him.
On Saturday, 13th of November, 1948, Peter Sellers appeared in the series Tempo for Today, followed by an appearance on Sunday in Variety Bandbox and a featured spot in Starlight Hour on the Monday. Would it not be helpful if the Variety booking manager were to inform producers if the artiste they are booking has already been engaged for the same or adjoining day?
Quite apart from his solo turns on Variety bills, Sellers had a regular booking from season to season on Ted Ray's show, Raise a Laugh. In the last 10 minutes of every edition, the character voices, Patricia Hayes, Fred Yule and Peter, came into their own.
Pardon me? Oh, a dancing class!
Oh, a man! Runaway girls and take your belly skirts off.
Who are you, madam?
Crystal Jollymuth and yourself.
You're the dancing mistress, I take it.
Yes, I am. And I'll thank you to keep your big nose out of me dying swan.
Can you give me a few pointers about the school?
No, I can't.
Come on, dancing mistress.
No, stop it.
Come on.
Oh, you pushed me down on me laughing samba.
Come on, darling, tell me.
No, no, I won't. Stop it.
Come on.
Oh, me castanets are caught round me Roger de Coverley.
Crystal Jollybottom was a hit for Sellers, but the favourite of the younger audience was his so-called soppy character, who started off as an insolent youth, but then, over successive series, regressed so far towards childhood he was well on his way to being Blue Bottle.
Hey, boy!
What do you want, soppy?
Hey, where's the boat train?
Oh, I don't know. I'm in charge of the tea, Trolley, and I'm not having any trap with you.
Now, don't you be rude to me, T-boy.
Let go of me! Two shareholders are all the same.
Well, where can I find out?
Wait for the lady station announcer.
Oh, yes. Is she pretty?
Yes. She's got a lovely little turned-up nose.
How nice.
And you've got a big red conch.
It's an example of Peter's outrageous cheek that, in his variety spots as an impressionist, one of the voices he did was the soppy character. He was impersonating himself.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is David Southwood, and as usual, my seat is in the circle. But there's a little boy sitting next to me who keeps shouting. I say, Sonny, would you mind being quiet, please?
You're soppy, you are.
I beg your pardon. I'm Southwood, not soppy.
You may be Southwood, but you're still
All the future goons were now making some sort of progress. Michael Benteen had an acclaimed stage act using that broken back of a chair to mime dozens of farcical possibilities. But as the Variety booking manager warned in a memo...
Whilst I have great admiration for Mr. Benteen's stage work, we must not forget that his value to radio has, at any rate so far, been somewhat limited, though this may well be our fault.
Spike Milligan had been writing gags, not many of them used on air, for Derek Roy, whose comedic skills can be judged by the fact that he billed himself as Dr. Roy, the Melody Boy, but it must be said that he also gave Galton and Simpson their first professional fee. But Spike's TV audition had gone well, as the result card still shows.
Description. Tall, good-looking man of medium colouring, in grey suit.
Performance?
Patter, burlesque impressions, vocal finish, etc.
Remarks.
Talent, good looks, and a pleasant singing voice make him a very good subject for TV, but his material needs careful attention as he's inclined to overdo the crazy parts. If the act is condensed and script vetted, should prove suitable for televariety.
Harry Secombe was also cheerfully overdoing the crazy parts in his radio variety appearances. This one happened more than a year before the crazy people came together for their first prototype series, which shows that the goons were advertising themselves by that name long before they had a broadcasting home of their own. Philip Slessor made the introduction on Variety Bandbox.
Time out now for lunacy. I noticed a considerable uproar among last week's bandbox audience, which, upon inquiry, I found was caused by a number of professional broadcasting goons who were taking a sort of busman's holiday and attending the programme. One of the noisiest, and certainly the craziest, of these demented individuals was an amiable maniac hailing from Wales called Harry Secombe.
What do you call me, Philip?
A maniac.
A maniac by the Gilded
Cage. Oh, no, Harry, no. Who taught you to sing?
My sister, George Secombe.
But, Harry, George isn't a girl's name.
I know.
Then why'd you call your sister George?
Well, when she knew I was her brother, she took it like a man.
Oh, no, this is too much, Harry. You ruffle my dignity.
No, you ruffle mine. It's got pleats in it.
Oh, you're completely unintelligible.
Now, Philip, this is no time for compliments. But time instead for one of Seacombe's bedtime stories for children. Bless them all. Bless them all. The long ends, the short ends. I beg your pardon. I got carried away. I'm not usually carried away till after the broadcast by two big men in uniform.
Although Milligan had only just begun to appear as a radio performer alongside the unvenerated Derek Roy, he contributed by proxy when Secombe broke into a version of the Eccles voice.
Ah, but the woodcutter's a simple man and asks, where are you going, Red? And she says, I'm not going Red anywhere, stupid. I'm on my way to visit my granny in her woodland cottage. Have you seen anything of her lately? And he says,
No, she keeps her key in the keyhole.
That was January 1950 with the trial recording for Crazy People still 13 months away. The birth of the goons was a long and arduous process. It was a shame that some interesting parts of the pregnancy go completely unremembered now. For example, several attempts were made to build shows around Peter Sellers. Frank Muir and I started the process off with a series called Third Division, which went by that title because it appeared on the third programme, Radio 3, for the younger married set. The producer was the pioneering Pat Dixon once again, and we fitted Benteen and Benny Hill into the cast along with Robert Beattie as a sort of semi-serious narrator. Later, a series called Sellers Castle or Tatters Castle was attempted, with Sellers as a ramshackle aristocrat. But not one of these experiments survives as a recording or even as a program file. Just one portion of one edition of Third Division lived on to earn a modest fame of its own, when later we revived it for a Sellers LP recorded by George Martin, Balham Gateway to the South, a lampoon of American travelogues in spite of the BBC's directive. It remains as a fragment of that dark age, an age of frozen winters, shortages, rations and regulations, and a lot of hopeful young men of medium colouring in grey suits trying to earn a respectable living by going crazy.
Night falls on Balham. From Quill's Folly, Balham's famous beauty spot, which stands nearly 10 feet above sea level, the town is spread below us in a fairyland of glittering lights, changing all the time. Green, amber, red, red and amber, and back to green. The nightlife is awakening. The El Morocco Tea Room.
Hi, miss.
Yes, what do you want?
Pilchards.
They're off, dear.
Baked beans?
Off.
Oh, meatloaf salad?
That's off, too.
Pot of tea?
No tea, dear.
Well, just milk, then.
Milk's off.
Roll and butter, then?
No butter, dear.
Oh, just a roll.
Only bread, love.
I might have just as well have stayed at home.
Well, I don't know. It does you good to have a fling occasionally.
And so the long night draws on. The last stragglers make their way home, and the lights go out one by one as dawn approaches and the bell of St. Quill's Parish Church tolls 10 o'clock. Balham sleeps. And so we say farewell to this historic borough with many pleasant memories. And the words of C. Quill Smith, Balham's own bard, burning in our ears.
Broad-bosomed, bold, becalmed, benign, lies Balham, four square, on the northern line. Matched by no marvel save in eastern scene, a rose-red city, half as gold as green. By country churchyard, ferny fen and mere, what Quills mute, inglorious, lies buried here? Oh, stands the church clock at 10 to 3, and is there honey still for tea?
Honey's off, dear.
Just Before Gunrise was presented by Dennis Norden, written by Russell Davies and a friend, and produced by Richard Edis, E-D-I-S, strange name.